jazz.
Do you have an intro? You probably have an intro. Do an intro.
Okay. Welcome to Jazz Bastard Podcast 111. Mike and I have both gotten our 90s on, and we've been talking about our favorite Hollywood stars and eating popcorn and just having a lot of fun, but things are getting a bit frisky. I think it's time for a pillow fight. What do you think, Mike?
That seems like it would involve just a little too much effort for the music we have lined up for today.
And I'm just horrified.
Could it be a feather fight? Could it be a feather fight? Could it be like a feather duel? Let's duel feathers.
Yeah, try not to use your imaginations and to evoke this scene visually, because it's really horrific. I apologize for that word picture I painted. Yeah, we're going to talk about four ECM releases from 2015 that Mike picked out for us. And the theory is we're going to get all the marshmallows out of the way at once and then go on to Grislier Fair.
Go on to jazz.
They say you're angry and rant mightily because I love the same as you.
Can we just rant before we get into specifics? Let's just rant about this for a minute, okay? So, like, Wynton has gone on the warpath about fusion. He needs to go on the warpath about ECM. Wynton, if you're listening, and I know you listen to every liquid gold drop that falls from our lips, you need to, like, do a jihad against ECM. Because ECM is a mighty, mighty machine. It is a very powerful musical engine. And if this is the shape of jazz to come, I'm going to become a traditionalist. I mean, fuck me sideways. This is enough is enough. I've just had it. I actually prefer smooth jazz. I prefer Kenny G's Songbird to one more misty North Sea fog befuddled 60-minute, 45-minute noodling in the world music closet. I'm just tired of this stuff. And we need to stop calling it jazz. I don't know what it is, but there are a couple of exceptions here. But this does not feel like jazz to me at all. It doesn't feel like third stream. It feels like its own special genre. And we need to just start calling it that. And the reason that I picked these up was I picked them up from the library. The San Diego Library seems to just suck from the nozzle of ECM, so they get every fucking ECM release. And when we look at AllMusic or other websites' best of selections, there's a lot of ECM on there. So these were all four albums that AllMusic, you know, was like best of, part of their big list, part of their like 80 album list or whatever. And so they all came from that list. And I'm like, okay, let's have a look. And I've heard of three of these people. And the fourth one has played on albums that I like a lot. So didn't seem like a leap into the mush. And then listening to them, I mean, I'm just like, where is the fiber? Where's the grit? And maybe this is a good example of why we should never do four ECMs at the same time again in the future. Because if they had been paired up against Ken Vandermark and Louis Armstrong and something else, we would have found more merit in them, perhaps, than I suspect we're going to find in them now. But I've just had it with jazz lists. I've had it with jazz lists and jazz publications swearing by this stuff as the future. It's just not. I'm very tired of this stuff. It has its merits, but man, I long for screaming saxophones and loud shredding guitars and angry Don Pullen piano as opposed to what we get here.
They say you're angry and rant mightily because I love the same as you.
That's my version of the rant. You have your rant. How does this make you feel as a whole?
You know, in some ways, maybe out of these four selections, I like two to varying degrees, and then other two I could do without. But even there, they're inoffensive at some level. It's just, as Mike said, they're kind of marshmallowy, and they aren't very jazzy, and they're kind of more about creating a mood than forwarding a musical agenda. And I guess the thing I want to bring up is that as a guy that and it's going to have to start cutting back, but going to record stores, used record stores. You know, I've been filling in my ECM collection, but it's been from the 80s. It's been from the – and this is a label that we're talking about 2015 releases, and I do feel that in the last 15 years or so, the remit has narrowed and the cliches have kind of multiplied, and there's a sense that it's almost becoming a parody of itself. But the thing is, you know, recently in the last few months, I picked up Steve Tibbetts, an album that he actually self-released and was re-released on ECM, YR, Your. That's my favorite Steve Tibbetts album. And again, you know, when I got Kenny Wheeler's Double W, which we talked about fairly recently, I love that record. So there are a lot of wonderful releases on ECM, but my sense is the density of those, the likelihood of coming up trumps, oh, that's not a word I should use now, is going down. I feel like that ECM is kind of drifting away from my favorite kinds of music that it released back in the 80s and 70s. I feel like it's increasingly getting down alleyways. I just don't want to follow it. And we've talked about that a bit before. We've actually talked about three of these artists before on podcast, Keith Jarrett and Tim Byrne, who I think the story here is actually a happy one compared to the original Snake Oil release.
Yeah.
And not Jacob Bro, but who's the other one? Oh, Kenny Wheeler. And
Kenny Wheeler.
You know, the Wheeler release here, we'll talk about it in more detail. I like okay. The main problem there is that Kenny is not in the shape he was.
No, 20 years ago. It's another one of these sunset discs that is really for completists. And if you're looking for Kenny at his best, it's not here. That's just not absolutely true.
Though I think the rest of the ensemble is fairly strong, and I think the compositions are fine. So anyway, where would you like to begin with this litany of soft and comfy albums?
Let's go from soft to less soft. So I think we need to start with everyone's favorite angry pianist, Keith Jarrett.
Remember the Muppet Show? Because all I can think of is,
well, we're the same age. I mean, we do.
Veterinarian hospital, the continuing story of a quack who's gone to the dogs, and one of these pieces from Keith Jarrett's 2015 release.
Creation.
It just begs to be made fun of. I mean, he is at this point. He's so talented, but he is a humorless, self-righteous, self-important, blowhard git. And when you hear this album, you just think, what a fucking asshole. And, you know,
it's strong, but
I mean, but that's how I, you know, and I, he is monumental talent. He is a great player. He is one of the great, great pianists in jazz, you know, I have enormous respect for him, but this is just so inflated. I mean, Creation, Part One. Part two, part three. I mean,
Keith moved upon the waters and he saw that it was good.
And, you know, and it takes all the slowest, least interesting parts of the Köln concert, which spawned new age music in a sense. The Köln concert was, you know, the great solo concert we talked about on the podcast. I think that's an ECM release too.
Yes.
Very early. Yeah. It made them. And it's full of brilliant playing and loads of self-indulgence and all kinds of interesting byways, and, you know, and it's endlessly interesting. And I think he fell in love with his navel and he just realized he could go in there and pull anything out of it and record it for ECM and it would sell like fucking hotcakes because everyone thinks it's going to be the second coming of the Köln concert. This isn't the second coming of the Köln concert. This isn't even the warm-up for the Köln concert. It is so self-righteous. It is so po-faced, so portentous and thudding and annoying. I mean, it just puts my back up in every way, which is weird because he's a great player. All the respect in the world for him, but this is a shitty album. I don't like this at all.
Yeah, we've done a couple releases by him. on 86, we talked about Sleeper, which is a very fine live session that he did that is definitely worth a listen. Originally recorded in 79, but released much more recently.
Right.
Look that one up. And then we did talk about the Coln Concert, a 1975 release back on episode 92. And that is where I revealed to the world that I did for a time belong to a New Age gang. So definitely look that one up. It's a sad period in my life. I don't like to talk about it much. And here, I got to admit, I was thinking, you know, this is as close as I've heard Keith Jarrett get to George Winston. Is this that different from Autumn at this point?
No.
Really? You know, the
difference is Autumn has a lightness of touch and a sense of humor. There's no humor here. There's not the least shred of a glimmer of a grin. Jarrett is working very hard,
and we know
you should be working very hard to understand and listen to him.
Yeah, and of course he could eat George Winston, shit him out for breakfast.
Of course.
You know, yeah. I mean, my God, he is just... So the difference between this live album and earlier ones he did, and Jarrett, we've talked about this before, ran into a nasty case of chronic fatigue syndrome. And so from a guy that would very energetically and intensely create 70-plus minute slabs of music, he just no longer did that. And he's kind of moved away from these very extended, symphonic almost, improvisations. And so what he's chosen to do here as his own producer... Do you hear that warning siren in the back?
Mm-hmm.
That's a warning siren.
Yeah,
it's like, well, I guess you made the label. Okay, fine. Manfred's just like shrugging in the background. He decided instead of presenting a concert, or as in the case of his recent four-disc set, multiple concerts to his public, he would take what he saw as excerpts that talk to one another or fit together in a narrative from multiple concerts and create a narrative from them. So this is a little different from most of his solo recitals. This is actually excerpts from multiple solo recitals. And as you said, I think he went looking for the most dull, low-energy, portentous pieces. I agree with you. I don't find this very appealing or very energizing or very insightful. It's not interesting.
And, it's bad. Let's just say it. This is bad. This is a bad album. Don't waste your money unless you're a Keith Jarrett completist. Do not waste your money on this unless you have to have every single thing he ever released.
And
this
if you
is
do,
not for you.
I hope
and if you,
have
you do,
a strong floor.
You're probably not listening there. You're probably not listening to our podcast if you do. But seriously, this is a bad album. This is a bad disc. And it's not that the playing is bad. It's just joyless, airless. There are so many things it's less. Pleasureless.
Well, and he's really scaled back and removed or dropped a lot of tools from his toolkit. And really, it's a way I thought of it was, let's say you're up in that garret songwriting guy and you're working for inspiration. And this is like 60 minutes from the cutting room floor before you get to the 3-minute pop song that someone's going to actually remember. It just never seems to reach an interest level that is worthy of publication. It doesn't, for me, create something of adequate musical interest to want to share with others. It's just not, you know, and again, he's very competent and it's moody. I don't think, as you said, it's just not very good as far as one can tell. And it's certainly not showing to any degree what Jarrett can do. Not that I'm demanding that he fire off a bunch of pyrotechnic finger busting displays of technical brilliance, but you know, you don't have that, but you also don't have grooves or vamps, and you don't have memorable harmonic or melodic ideas. It just doesn't seem very interesting. Yeah,
that's a good point. I mean, the Coln Concert has lots of very pretty passages. It has lots of moments of really just sparkling melodic beauty, haunting, that stay with you. And this is just kind of thudding and ponderous. It's as if he decided to make an album about the act of creation by an angry Old Testament God who never smiled and just kind of banged the universe into being. It's a very unhappy occasion, if you ask me. This does not give me pleasure. And it doesn't put me to sleep either. I was going to say it puts me to sleep, but it doesn't, because it demands attention. And, you know, I've just decided after this, I'm not listening. I'm not going to pick up any Keith Jarrett solo recordings unless I vet them heavily first. From now on, I'm sticking with him in trios. You know, as long as Jack DeJohnette and Gary Peacock are involved, okay. But solo discs, I want to hear it before I decide. Yeah. And to plump out $20 for it.
Sure. And I mean, and back in the 70s, both the European and American quartets are, I think, very fine ensembles. He's made a lot of great music. Yes. Sleeper demonstrates that. But
oh, yeah.
And of course, many, many of his recordings. But yeah, I would agree. I've got it going back to our discussion of it. For me, the Colin concert does not create a genre in which I have very deep interest. It's interesting to see the reviews of Creation, because some, of course, praise it to the skies, and some are a bit critical and willing to kind of question, is this useful? And to me, in general, the solo recital with no substance or no music planned ahead of time, this idea that you're going to improvise a whole creation from quote unquote whole cloth, you know, it's completely improvised. I've rarely found that very musically productive. It's fascinating. I think it'd be fascinating to hear it in real time once, but as a recording, I just think rarely does it add up to something as good as the average jazz exploration of a standard, or somebody sitting down and working through melodic ideas until they boil them down to an essence that's a song or right. a symphony or whatever, a composition of some kind that, you know, has been through the fire and been and kind of the essence of it has been discovered, rather than the process of discovery, which I just don't find that interesting.
You know, the player he reminds me of in some way. Well, so I'm going to draw two analogies here. Sometimes in Hollywood, actors strike it rich. They have a run of films and they become minor institutions. And then they think that they themselves are what kind of made those institutions. And they become po-faced and self-righteous and boring. And it takes, so they have to like appear in an indie flick to kind of recover credibility. Harrison Ford is a great example. You know, after all of those blockbuster movies, he suddenly, you know, it's like, why isn't anyone coming to see my movies anymore? You know, and it's like, because you're an angry old man telling people to get off the fucking lawn. You need to appear for, you know, scale in an indie flick and show people that you can actually make fun of yourself. And he did that in a couple of movies.
Yeah,
that I mean, too.
Yeah.
But you know, at least to make fun of yourself, right? Yeah. And Jarrett's at that place. Jarrett's at that place where it's like, his shit is golden. And you know what? His shit's just shit. This is shit. And just because the great Keith Jarrett, who is, you know, a monumentally talented jazz player, probably the greatest living jazz pianist of his generation when he wants to be, just because he records it doesn't mean it's good. This is an off day. This isn't a good day for him. And there's no humor here. There's no sense of being able to laugh at himself. There's no sense of just joy or pleasure. If there is, it's a peculiar joy or pleasure that's so private that it's uncommunicable to the audience that listens to this particular recording. He needs to go woodshed. He needs to go like down to like some sleazy club and just drop in on the local trio and say, hey, can I sit in and just,
not
you know, play St. St. Louis Blues 5 or 6 times. And rediscover something, because man, the energy and the joy and the infectious pleasure that he can bring, man, it's not here. And the player he reminds me of sometimes in his sternness and seriousness of demeanor is Brad Meldow. But Meldow has a sense of humor, and Meldow will dabble in genres that don't, you know, he doesn't sound like an oracular prophet coming from the mountain to deliver his latest installment. I mean, he has that side, no doubt, but he also plays electronica and he plays pop music in a jazz idiom, and he's willing to let his hair down and appear in different settings. So he seems to still have at least a sense of self-awareness that isn't all about whatever I think must be wonderful. He's willing to branch out and be a sideman in other people's projects.
Yeah. I mean, that said, you know, we talked about Meldow's 10-year solo life on that same 92 episode.
Yeah.
We talked about the Colin concert, and I think the same problem pertained to some degree in that
yes,
he was his own editor. I just don't know that for the most part musicians...
Did he edit? Was there editing?
Yeah, I know. It is four CDs or eight LPs. There's a lot. And of course,
right.
Jarrett recently released another four concerts of his, and you get the sense that Manfred is not sure about this, but Manfred is going to, you know, let Keith. It's funny because in a way, if our thesis here for 2015 ECM is that Manfred Eicher is kind of getting into a rut and maybe taking artists down the wrong path at this point as a producer, that he's gotten a little bit too cliched and narrow in his understanding of what music can be at this late stage of what's been an extraordinarily prolific and successful career aesthetically and, you know, and to some degree economically. Here, Manfred is not driving the bus. He's going to defer to Jarrett in part because the Colin concert is what established ECM as an economically viable label.
Right.
And that's why they've had this amazing run of decade after decade of being able to kind of produce music that whatever you want to say is you know, only appeals to a minority of listeners. You know, it's an independent label, finally.
Right. Don't you think Jarrett needs to play with, like, Snarky Puppy or...
Oh, God.
You know, I mean, but seriously, I mean, just get the stick out of your ass. And he's such a great player. He's such a great player.
Yeah, well,
you know?
He's never been... Because you have some players, like, there are the people that stand alone in splendid isolation. Sonny
right.
Rollins would be a great example
right.
where he wants reliable backup, but he doesn't finally look to other players
right.
to create a stimulating context or to respond to. He is Sonny.
Right.
And then you got people that are almost entirely dependent on context. And Jarrett, mm-hmm. I feel like, is... He's not quite at the Sonny Rollins end,
nope.
but he tends to be very particular about the company he keeps.
Mm-hmm.
And that company tends to be a very high-level players of his generation.
Yep.
I can't think of Jarrett appearing in a project with somebody 20 years or more younger. Now, please, listeners, if you know of such a thing, I'm not by any means a Jarrett encyclopedia. I don't know everything he's done, and I don't think I ever will. But if you can think of some projects he's done with people 20 years younger than him or not, let us know. But I
yeah.
think of him as somebody. And, you know, one thing I noticed about these projects is, in a way, even though these were all released in 2015, you've got artists who are from different generations.
Mm-hmm.
So Jarrett is born in 45. Kenny Wheeler, we're going to get to in a minute, was born in 1930. Tim Byrne in 1954, so about 10 years after Jarrett, who is 15 years after Kenny. And then Jacob Rowe from 78.
Mm.
So we miss anybody born in the 60s, but we're really looking at artists who each come from a different decade in terms of, you know, when they were born and the people they know. And for Jarrett, I feel like very much, has he played with anybody born after 1960? I can't think of any. I might just be ignoring something obvious, but I don't think of him as somebody that, think of somebody who's very
right.
exclusive in his musical friendships. You know, he's not a Chick Corea mm-hmm. who's kind of out there.
Right, who's,
you know,
Catholic and he'll play with anyone.
Right,
yeah.
exactly. Yeah.
You know, the person he should play with who has as big an ego and as large an appreciation of classical forms, the person he should play with who is 20 years younger is Wynton Marsalis. They should play on a disc together. But
okay.
can you imagine? Well, but I mean,
want it, to.
I know. But don't you think that would strike sparks? Don't you think something good possibly could happen there? Jarrett could,
maybe.
You know, Jarrett could, you know, do his thing, and Wynton could make him play some Jelly Roll, and, you know, it'd be a lot of fun.
You know, thinking about those two figures, both of whom have, and I should know because I've got a decent one myself, enormous egos.
Mm-hmm.
Keith, I tend to think of as, I think the term is vatic, you know, the priestly sense of
yes.
inspiration flowing through him and making him a holy figure, one of the great
yeah,
conduits
right.
of the cosmic mind. And Wynton is a little different from that. I think for me,
he's in touch with the tradition. He's the
yeah,
latest
superpower,
prophet.
Yes. Right, tends to be that I know history and my authority is a kind of paternal authority that
right.
comes from ancestors.
From honoring the tradition. Down. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so because they're both very bossy and they're both very opinionated. They're both very technically talented. I mean, I tend to
massive,
think of Jarrett
massive
as, yeah.
egos. Can you imagine? It would be, I mean, how would you like to be the producer on that date? Just, you'd just
no,
be,
thank you.
laid out on Valium all the time. Just be like, please, God, let this be over.
Well, and he is, yeah, Jarrett, I don't think of somebody as, I think there can be joy in Jarrett's playing. I don't know if I can think of any humor in Jarrett's playing.
Exactly.
Whereas with Wenton, there's an awful lot of puckishness and sly humor.
Exactly. Yes,
so
yes.
Sometimes I do feel like I'm missing the joy. So, yeah, wow. That's not who I'd pick. I think I'd pick, who was that Icelandic woman with the electric guitar? I think I'd pick
Mette Henriette?
Well, no. She was the one with the saxophone that, like, would play.
Oh, no.
No. Oh, my God, no. No.
I know who you're talking about. What's her name? I can see her blonde
Hedvig
hair now.
Or something. Anyway.
Hedvig Mahler.
Something like that, yes. This is a distortion.
Hedvig.
Press it. You would like, the sounds.
Do what I say.
yeah. That's not going to happen. But yeah.
That would never happen.
I'm glad you brought that up because, yeah, he's not a promiscuous collaborator. He is very much in his tower of Jarrettness, and only very few people are allowed in. Okay, so who is next on the mellow
working,
scale,
working up the scale towards something a little more.
Something with a spine. We're still at the invertebrates. Okay.
Right. We're looking for fiber here. So that was about as loose a stool as you can have. And this is a little more, yeah. So let's turn to Jacob Bro.
Bro's album Geffen. Okay, that's where
or
that's
I
go.
Yeah. So I have a thing for this, and I think it would go something like this: knock, 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 knock.
Who's that?
Jacob Bro.
Jacob Bro, who?
No, not Jacob Bro. Sorry. It's excuse me. It's Bill Frisell. He wants his sound back, motherfucker. My God, this is like Bill Frisell without the Americana. I mean, it really is.
And Bill. In his later, less energetic years, with three-fourths of his notes repossessed for lack of payment. So it's just a minimalist, frictionless Frisell, which it's like he's boiled down the essence of the Frisell I don't like that much in the first place.
Yes.
Not the Frisell that I treasure and love.
And we should go on record right now and say that the other two players here are ECM stalwarts as well. John Christensen on drums, who's got to have appeared on more ECM dates than anyone at this point. And Jakob. I want to say Jakob. Doesn't it seem like it should be Jakob, not Jacob? Jakob.
Probably.
Jakob Bro has appeared on some of my favorite Tomasz Stanko discs.
Okay.
Now, Tomasz Stanko is that Polish trumpeter who is sort of to the trumpet on ECM what Jarrett on piano is to ECM, except that there's all, you know, he's very lugubrious and haunted. He's sort of like, think of Miles Davis of the Aura record, that kind of sound.
Sure.
And that's kind of his niche. He can be a flute player, but that's not what he does. He sort of goes, you know, he's a classic kind of ECM player with these sort of haunting lines and smears from, you know, the latter end of Miles Davis's career. Okay, fine. So Jakob Bro played on at least two of the discs I love by Tomasz Stanko. So he's appeared on a bunch of dates, respectable dates.
And the third player in this trio is Thomas Morgan on bass, who gets featured fairly well, you know, he gets some nice woody sounding solos.
Yes.
And I feel like you can hear a bit of it, and I'm sure John Christensen was there. But
mostly on the cymbals. Did he hit the drums at all? Was there any? Did you hear snare here anywhere?
Oh yeah, he definitely had that double bass drum thing go.
Just not a lot of, you
hardcore
know.
Hardcore punk. Yeah.
Lot of brushwork. Lots of brushwork.
Oh, my God. Like, so, yeah, Bro was a guitar player who came out of the Frizzell School and decided what this needs is 75% less notes and 85% less energy. And, yeah, this is a, wow, this is kind of a sleepy old date, isn't it?
I want to be clear. I mean, so Bro can play. I mean, he can play. But, yeah, it is so drifty and moody, and I don't dislike this disc, but man, talk about trying to find the jazz content. At least it's not po-faced and portentous like Jarrett. It's a little less self-important. It's straight down the line ECM, you know.
It's innocuous, yeah. Kind of.
It's innocuous. Fog coming in on the harbor. Yeah.
Yeah.
What some people might call coffee shop music. So, I mean, I don't dislike it. And it's clear he's a good player. And I like John Christensen on other dates. John Christensen can play more than just brushes on cymbals, which seems to be all he does here. But could you tell any of these songs apart? If
songs?
I played 10 seconds, I played 20 seconds out of Copenhagen and then 20 seconds out of Airport Poem, would you be able to tell the difference?
And note that title, listeners.
Yes.
Airport Poem. It's just kind of like, well, at least you're not hiding what you're after here. My God. No, there
or
is no way.
White.
Now.
Which is a metaphor for all ECM music, apparently. Just a song called White.
If you like white. This, you could be. You might be.
Right.
Yeah.
Things that are white. Lutefisk.
Oh, God.
All Swedish food.
Yeah, I can't
Everything
wait.
Everything in the ECM catalog.
Yeah, listeners, by August, that's where I'm going to be. So, yeah. Yeah, it's, wow. It is just a spectacularly minimalist, innocuous, pleasant, but completely ungripping, unlife-changing album. It just, yeah, I just can't imagine listening to that and really having any opinion about it or any particular interest in figuring out who was on it or wanting to hear more from them. Though, of course, if you heard more from them, you wouldn't be offended or upset. It doesn't seem like it's asking of you what Jarrett's album seems to demand right. from you and right. then not reward. It's like, give this right. your full attention. This is really, really important. And you're like, no, it's boring. I mean, here, this is just, it's kind of background music, but it really just seems to be kind of a cliched caricature of what we think of ECM music being. It's just yeah. like almost kind of a parody. It's so ridiculously drifting and introspective, but again, not with, you know, I talked about Ben Webster last time and the fact that, yes, he plays this in the style, but what makes it interesting and gives it grit is the fact that, one, the incredible nuance and spin he brings to every single phrase, and two, the fact that he violates his own rules. He will growl. He will raise his dynamics at times. It's not just one endless murmur. It's a man expressing himself, and there's colors to it, even though it is stylized. It's in a style. This, I just feel like, is just stylized. I don't feel like a personal expression or message is peeking through it. It's wallpaper.
Yeah, I have no bad feelings about this, but I have no warm feelings either.
Or just no feelings, maybe?
Just no feelings. It's innocuous. It doesn't hurt. It's unlike the Jarrett. Yeah, everyone knows how I listen to these things by now. I put them, I will listen to them a couple times straight through, but generally they're on a playlist on random, so they pop up at different times. And when Jakob Bro Geffen comes on any of these songs, I can continue to do whatever I'm doing, reading, whatever. It's just there. You know, when Jarrett's playing comes on, maybe this is a compliment to him. I don't know. When any of his songs come on, I'm like, oh, this, you know, and my teeth set. It demands my attention. And then I have to sort of focus on not giving it my attention, whereas this doesn't demand my attention at all. Which isn't to say it's bad. It's just not. It doesn't feel very engaged. It doesn't feel very energetic. It doesn't feel very anything.
It seems like music for use. It seems like I can imagine parties or situations or just like to me, if I'm feeling tense at work and I, for whatever reason, need to be calmed down and made as productive as humanly possible, put on the Swingle Singers. You know, there's a use for that, which is this French bounciness, blah, blah, blah. You know, the constant swing beat, it's going to get me through something. I don't think it's deep music, but it creates a mood and an environment. And I feel like that's the most you can say for this. If you really need something to accompany that nice warm glass of tea as you, and I mean warm, not hot, as you lean back on your eloquently cushioned couch and think about how cute your cat is, this is a music for you to ignore while you do those things.
If you need something to listen to while you knit a new sweater.
There you go. Because it's cold in Sweden sometimes. And those long, dark nights, you need something to keep your hands busy.
Well, he's Danish. Let's be clear. Let's not confuse our Norwegian. Let's not confuse our Scandinavian countries. He is Danish, and we don't want to insult him. And maybe much better. And I know he's much better in other settings, more energy. But yeah, this is just...
Yeah. Ugh. But anyway, so... Warning about that. The name's not been on my radar, but it's still not on my radar after this.
So if you spent money on this, it wouldn't be money wasted unless you wanted something to, you know, pep you up, in which case it would be money wasted. All right.
Like how much more Earl Grey you could have bought with that money.
Exactly.
That's what we're saying.
Right. Let's go to Kenny Wheeler, Songs for Quintet.
Okay. Yeah, that's where I would have assumed we'd go next. And we did talk about Wheeler's very fine release, Double W,
yes,
before. And boy, that's excellent. And mm-hmm. I've got to admit, I want to go back and listen to some of those earlier 70s ECM releases he did. We talked about Double W on Podcast 94. And that's a good one. Look that one up. And for whatever reason, I went back. There was a period in the 80s. When Dave Holland's Quintet released like three albums in a row that all pretty much got 5 stars from all the magazines, and I ended up getting 2 of them on LP and then 1 on CD, and he had this quintet that had Steve Coleman in it and Kenny Wheeler. And it was just odd because, you know, I was trying to figure out, how did this ensemble come to be? I mean, they're all kind of ECM stalwarts. But this was a group that Wheeler was born in 1930. For a while, Julian Priester, the trombone player, was in it. He's from 35. Holland was born 1946. Coleman was born in 1956. And one of the drummers in the group's, Marvin Smitty Smith, 61. So it really was an intergenerational group.
Mm.
Holland was 15 years younger than Wheeler and 10 years older than Coleman. And I like it. I would recommend of those releases, Jumpin' In, I think, is the best one.
Mm.
Seeds of Time has this weird song that's kind of a skit about conflict and traffic that Coleman came up with. And Steve Coleman is very much Steve Coleman. I mean, if you know Steve Coleman's work, when you hear it in this quintet, you'll say, that is fucking Steve Coleman, isn't it?
Yeah.
And Wheeler, you know, I realized I don't think I've ever heard Wheeler apart from the ECM cocoon. Mm. And I kind of associate Wheeler's playing, whether trumpet or flugelhorn, with that echo. And, of course, I like Angel Song quite a bit, this album he made, the drummerless session that he made. I think Holland's on that one, too. Lee Konitz is on it, and it's just it's a magnificent, as far as a great example of the ECM drifting, melancholy, mist-swept sound, that, to me, is that working as it is very best. It's firing on all cylinders. I just think that album's great. And then I like a little bit more harder edge stuff with Michael Brecker and Double W.
Right.
This is kind of Kenny at the very end of the road. It was recorded in 2013, released in 2015. Of course, Kenny's no longer with us. And while the group is not quite the high power names that he's, you know, some of his recordings are really just all star dates. I think they're all fine, but Kenny himself is kind of not as strong, right?
Yeah. Let me go back to one thing you said before we dive into this album, which is we have certain heroes that we talk about from time to time on the podcast, and we've talked about him. We've talked about a couple of his albums. We did a solo album of his, and of course, Conference of the Birds. So we've elevated to the kind of like the Jazz Bastard pantheon, like get anything by him because it's bound
Dave
to be pretty
Holland,
good.
You're talking about,
So you know, we've Bobby Hutcherson, we've talked about extensively, is kind of in that mold. Yeah, Dave Holland is too. I mean, I can't think of an album with Dave Holland on it where I thought, well, that wasn't very interesting. I think he's a fantastic player. Just elevates everything he's in, and every disc that I have by him is a delight, and anything that he plays on, even if he's not the leader, it's usually worth your time, worth the candle. So,
and listeners, we're going to test this hypothesis in a few episodes, because his recent release, I've got, he's in a couple of fusion-y things, and the most recent one I want to bring up. And I will say this, the Quintet albums, I ended up with all of them, and I like them all. But by the end, the Razor's Edge, I do feel like the ECMification was kind of starting to drown out my interest. The echo just got a little bit too fucking much. And it's fascinating to listen to the three recordings they did. As I said, Jumpin' In's my favorite, Seeds of Time is okay. And then Razor's Edge, it's almost like Manfred is putting a darker and darker thumbprint on the project. And it's getting a little bit too swathed. So, yeah, there are times that his playing can get a little bit cold. I'm talking about Dave Holland. You know, that group at times got a little chilly for my taste. But Wheeler, in his own settings, mostly he finds a home in ECM that works for his approach. You know, it is his kind of melancholy, a little off-center. He can be a little avant-garde more than you might think if you go back to earlier stuff. It kind of works with the sound that Manfred's getting pretty well. Here, it just... Yeah, he's just, you know, this is an end of the road statement, right?
Yeah, and the biggest drawback here is he's just not in good form. You can tell he knows what he wants to do, and as you pointed out earlier, the compositions are pretty tight. They're interesting, but man, he has trouble sustaining the simplest lines. He wavers on notes, you know. I mean,
he's in his 80s.
He's in his 80s.
And it's tough to be a brass player in your, I mean, it's tough to be anybody in your 80s playing a horn or whatever, but to be a brass player,
especially for, your lip goes. And so some players find ways to compensate, and you'd think that with the kind of style of music, you might be misled into thinking, oh, well, that would be perfect for when you get older and your lip isn't what it was. But in fact, I think oddly, one of the things this disc demonstrates is how fucking hard it is to do what he does, and that it demands a really high level of ability. And the fact that he can't quite muster up that level of play here, I think testifies to how, I think it casts retrospectively a kind of half star and everything else he did for ECM, because everything he does on ECM you think is so, it's so easy and so moody and melancholy, and gosh, anyone can do that. And in fact, not anyone can. It's really hard. Even Kenny Wheeler can't do it in his last date where he's dying.
Right.
So
I mean, it sounds unforced, but it's actually got a lot of technical chops behind it.
You know, those
sound like a player showing off, but
right. Those smears, those dying falls, that all takes enormous control, enormous breath control, and he can't do it here. He just can't. The producer, if it's Manfred, smartly gives everyone else tons of room to stretch out.
Yeah.
So Stan Salzman on saxophone here is very good. He's not, I guess, what one would think of as a front rank player, but the support he offers here is really able. It's really good, I think. And it helps distract, I think, sometimes from the wobbly technique of the leader. Everyone's pretty good, but I really noticed Salzman. Is that who stuck out for you? Or
I think that this is a weird record because in certain ways it's pretty successful. And I got to say that if I put it on, I mostly enjoy it. I don't feel like this is as extreme a case as the Harold Land album that we talked about, where Harold was just so painfully flat.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you focus in on it, it's very evident that Kenny is struggling.
Yes.
And it's weird because you feel like, and I wonder too, I'm fascinated by this gap, and I really wonder, and this is pure speculation, that Kenny made the session, they put it in the vault, and then when he died, they thought, well, you know, this is his mm-hmm. final statement, let's release it. Whereas,
yeah.
you know,
because they knew they were going to get, yet they knew that a bunch of jazz publications were going to have orgasms. And the fact is, this is not up to par with his best work. It just isn't. It just
isn't.
Not.
And that's the thing. I mean, in a sense, the only I don't feel bad about the existence of this album in a way that I kind of do about that Harold Land album we talked about. Where yeah. I feel like that was just kind of an unkind part of his legacy. And we're talking about Kenny Wheeler's Songs for Quintet, the 2015 release. But at the same time, I feel like if you want to get to know Kenny Wheeler's art, it'd be a tragedy if this is what you found and this is where you began. Don't go here. Go to right. anything really from a decade earlier all the way back to the 60s, because this guy has been around. Again, he was born in 1930. And real quickly, it's Stan Saltzman saxophone, John Parcelli guitarist. Hey, I don't think that was a ridiculous attempt. Bassist Chris
oh.
Lawrence, drummer Martin France.
Parcelli. You said Parcelli. I'm going to go with Parcelli, but hey, you know.
I said Parcelli, but if
oh, I heard Parcelli, so my bad. I'm sorry.
Anyway, you know I'm going to get it wrong. You just don't know how. I mean, that's my great inventiveness. So, yeah, don't go to Songs for Quintet for Kenny, but do explore this guy. You know, one of the interesting things about the Holland Quintet from the 80s is this is a guy 15 years older than the leader who is become, you know, a sideman in a sense.
Right.
It gives you a sense of the fact that Wheeler was always kind of a lesser known figure, despite the fact that he's a fine composer. I mean, there's kind of a family resemblance in a lot of his compositions, but I like them. And he's made some fine records, but he never became the kind of name that would get his own dates very often. He's the kind of guy that would be a sideman in a band where his leader was 15 years younger than him. And the other side, you know, one of the other horns was like, you know, even more, 20, 25 years younger than him. So it's just kind of a interesting career arc, but productive. Just don't go here for second, third, fourth, or fifth. You know, if you really become a completist, I think it's probably worth hearing.
Another thing I would say about that is if you are a Kenny Wheeler fan, then it's okay to listen to this. And I think the primary reason to listen to this, apart from, I think the compositions, as you said, hold up. I think they're interesting. The primary reason for me was to hear just how difficult it is to do what he does.
Right.
That was the lesson I took away from this. I was like, God, if we could have heard Kenny 10 years before playing this, he would have killed this. And this would be a half star better. It's not bad as it is, but you can see just how hard it is to do what he does. What he does is not simple. It's not easy at all.
Despite the fact that he is the opposite of a Dizzy Gillespie figure who's soaring into the stratosphere and playing
yeah.
lots of fast patterns. Yeah, he's a great musician. I have rarely come across a performance of his that I did not enjoy. But yeah, this is very much in the twilight kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so finally, we get to Tim Byrne again. We did Snake Oil. Yes, thank God.
Something with fiber.
This is a group called Snake Oil. It's third release. You've been watching me, but we did talk about Snake Oil's first release on ECM, which was just called Snake Oil, back on episode, good grief, 22. I not realize it was that long
ago.
Wow,
that's a long time.
And there we felt like Manfred had kind of swathed him in cotton.
He had neutered him. He'd emasculated yes. him. He'd cut his balls off.
Tim found his balls.
He made Manfred give them back. He said, give them back. I need my balls.
Genitalia restored. So, yeah, this group, he's now expanded. And this is a group with no bass, which seems to be a pattern in some of these ECM releases. And I realized, thinking back, that way back, the recording that really turned me on to Tim Byrne was his brief stay on Columbia. And Fulton Street Mall was the first of two albums they released before they realized, wait a minute, we fucking signed Tim Byrne. What were we thinking? And bumped him as quickly. This isn't Wynton Marsalis's friend. This is, you know, this is avant-garde shit. And that was a quartet he had with Hank Roberts on cello. I cannot remember the drummer. It might have been Kenny Barron. And Bill Frisell on guitar. And I love that record so much. And that was another group that did not have a bass. But anyway, in this group, he's got a clarinet player who plays both bass and a regular clarinet. He's added a guitarist, which I think helps.
Yes.
And there's a drummer there. And everything, it just feels like that he is kind of aesthetically back in the driver's seat. This has not been swathed in the ECM reverberation so badly. And it just seems like a lot ballsier album. So who am I trying to think of? So Matt Mitchell's piano, Chez Smith on drums, Ryan Ferrara on guitar, and Oscar Noriega on clarinets. Mike just loves it when I attempt anything that's not Smith or Brown. Endlessly entertaining. So anyway, Snake Oil, but he's added his guitar player, and boy, what a difference a couple of years makes. This just is a much stronger release, I think.
Oh, absolutely. It's well out, but not completely out. It doesn't devolve into noise. Like Tim Byrne operates in that sort of, I think of that as that sort of place where out playing is just a little bit off the edge of in, where they can come back to something that resembles a theme or a statement or a melody, but can get reasonably far out. I think of like Don Pullen here, but that kind of thing.
Very OCD, right? I mean, he's not an Auburn Isler. He's not interested in folk music. His great influence and mentor was Julius Hemphill, who, of course, died fairly young, one of the pivotal members of the World Sax Quartet.
In fact, isn't he on one of, isn't Tim Byrne or is it Marty Ehrlich that you're thinking of?
They might both be on one of, and of course, towards
Julius has like an all horn ensemble.
Yes.
He has an album of the 5-chord stud or something where Hemphill doesn't play. But yeah, you're right. That's right. Tim Byrne does. I think he's on 5-chord stud. And Hemphill at that point wasn't able to play, but it was his album. It was his compositions.
And I
think Ehrlich.
Ehrlich may have been there. And Byrne has done tributes to Hemphill and Hemphill compositions.
That's right.
And he still gives props to Hemphill now.
Yes.
So, yeah.
That is exactly right. It's Tim Byrne, Marty Ehrlich, James Carter.
Oh, yeah.
I forgot about that. And Fred Ho on baritone, among others.
Jesus.
So,
Christ.
That's a hell of an album.
That's
a great album. And I don't think Hemphill even plays on it.
Towards the end, he was too ill to play.
Heart surgery. Yeah. So.
Yeah, he is a structuralist. He is a little OCD. He's a little obsessive. There are winding. One thing that strikes me about his compositions is it's sort of like, can you guess the next chord? There will be no cadences here. It's the opposite like a blues song. It is a series of almost seemingly random harmonic moments, but they are not purely dissonant. There are definitely rules in place here.
There are, and he is really good about building and releasing tension.
Oh, yes.
One of my pet peeves. I mean, Lost in Reading, the opener, just is a textbook example of how to do this.
Which,
fantastic.
I don't know if you had a chance, but Lost in Reading strikes me as exactly the same song as one of the tunes off the original Snake Oil album with a totally different title. So I don't know whether he's just, you know, he's going back to compositions and trying them out again. And the next tune is this epic thing that just builds and builds and builds until it just seems ready to explode. And that was something, an almost rock-like feeling that some of the Fulton Street Mall way back in the 80s had. And I like that in some ways when Byrne's a little bit more direct and a little bit more willing to kind of just go for broke, I like him because he's one of those players I feel like whose OCD tendencies are best leavened with a little bit of anarchy or a little bit of just rocking out. Recently, I was listening to some of those old live recordings from Greg Osby. I'm like, God, these are so fucking good. You know, another player who I think benefits from letting his hair down a bit, even though Greg Ausby has been bald for a very long time. But you know, metaphorically speaking, Kim's not. He's got a magnificent mane.
Crazy curly, like graying shots.
Oh, yes. But he has been an absolutely uncompromising, you know, avant-garde voice for decades. He's self-produced for a very long time, had his own labels, his own projects. And he learned some of that business end of music from Hemp Hill as well. This idea that, you know, if you want to express yourself, do your own work, release your own work.
Right.
And then, you know, having joined ECM, I really feel like that first Snake Oil release, and he appeared, I think, as a sideman on a couple of releases I've not heard yet, was a little too Manfreded. And yeah, I feel like he's out from under the thumb here. It sounds a little bit more like the Tim we know and love. It's a little more abrasive and in your face, not to a ridiculous degree, but enough that it feels like it's got some grit. So
yeah, it's far and away the best of the discs we're listening to. Ooh, this week. Yeah. If this is the way forward for ECM, God, let's have more of this. It's fantastic. I really like this album quite a bit. Our listeners who are looking for melody or bebop trading of solos are not going to be happy. But if you've got a little angular in your head, if you like spiraling noise and confusion, but not total chaos,
right,
this is your disc. It's really good. And, you know, Byrne will admit he's not like, you know, he's a limited player. And a lot of what he does involves being in a setting, creating these sort of swirling soundscapes where he can do what he does to the best of his ability. And I really feel like he's kind of hitting on all cylinders here. He's kind of got this worked out here. This is light years better than that other disc to be talked about.
Yeah, right. The original Snake Oil album, this is just leaps and bounds better. It definitely rewards cranked up listening.
Yes, and you will attend to it. Like, you won't not be able to. It's gonna.
And
it's
so will
this
your
is
neighbors.
Not a. Yeah. This is not a kitty cat. It's gonna crawl up to you and say, "Do you like me?" This is a dog. It's gonna jump on you and pee on your lap. You know, this is.
I don't know. Yeah, it's a. Maybe it's an entirely different animal. I'm not sure. Maybe it's a lemur.
It's
or something.
True.
I don't know. Yeah,
that's right. Whatever it is, it's energetic and it's gonna be up in your face.
But
yes.
But very demanding and
yes.
But at the same time, I think rewarding. And there is, as I said, there's this mix of extremely almost cerebral, bizarrely patterned, very non-cadence, non-traditional harmony stuff going on with a willingness to kind of crank things up and build tension in a way that reminds me of, you know, a good rock song going chorus after chorus and getting crazier every time, right? A kind of a building intensity that it almost has a rock edge. So it's kind of a neat meeting of the very, you know, cerebral or mental or intellectual side and the kind of just let's freak out and rock out side. And all the, you know, I think the playing's fine. The clarinet does not seem as recessive here as it did in the previous work. And I'm not, there's an intermediary release I've not heard of this group. This is the third ECM release of Snake Oil, the ensemble. But it's a great relief, and it's nice to think that, well, somebody is escaping the cocoon and is not being ushered to death.
What also is nice is, I mean, the one thing we'll never complain about on ECM releases is they are masterfully recorded. They sound fucking fantastic. I mean, they just sound great. They're engineered really well. And it's a pleasure to hear a disc like this with that same loving attention to soundcraft. It doesn't just have to be echoey trumpets in the
distance.
That's
the thing. Yeah. If he takes his foot off the reverb pedal, he's a magnificent producer. It's just sometimes you feel like that temptation of, again, a kind of almost parody of itself, the ECMification of certain music that just sands away the rough edges, adds just a little too much echo, makes it a little too moody, and just seems to sap the vitality out. And again, for whatever reason, that happened on Snake Oil, the original album, and doesn't happen here. We're not quite in. You talked extensively about David Sanborn's release last episode and how brutally undoctored the sound of Sanborn's alto was on that album that he released, Time of the River. But we're not quite there, but we're close enough that you feel like they're actual human beings and instruments playing, not this echoing dreamscape. So
yeah.
Anyway, it was a real relief because I was not particularly looking forward to this, fearing that it would be another example of Tigger after being taken down from the tree and de-Tiggerfied, and a sadder Tigger, a wiser Tigger, a Tigger who doesn't want to jump. And Byrne's got his bounce back here, which is great.
Yeah, it's definitely the best of the four this week and highly recommended, I think, for both of us. It's a lot of pleasure.
Absolutely.
If you don't like this kind of thing, stay away. But if you have any tolerance for angularity and tension and reliefs and not a strict adherence to melody, then go for it. I think you'll like this disc a whole bunch. Don't be put off by the ECM blurry cover art.
Well, actually, I noticed it's actually the photograph on this one is sharper than the photograph on the Snake Oil debut. It's like even the cameraman got the message that this is actually going to have sharper edges. So
I want some edges.
You know,
I want to be able to identify the members of the band in this picture.
Oh, my God. Yeah. So, and if you want further recommendations of recent ECM recordings, listen to another podcast for the next couple of months, because by God, that's the end for a while. We're talking about other stuff.
Poor baby. You make me suffer through all kinds of shit. And, you know, well.
You were yourself were ranting about this.
I know. I suffered too. But I have to tell you, there are some ECM things out there that we should look at, but we should be a little more judicious. For example, Mark Turner had a release on ECM in 2015. Don't you think that might be worth listening to?
We'll see. Does he do the duck walk or the chicken walk or whatever? That yeah, we'll have to see. I'm not sure that he is an artist I want to hook up with ECM. I feel like maybe he needs to be on.
It depends on who's with him. It really
John Zorn's label or something.
Yeah.
But that is the story. Our pillow fight is done. The feathers are drifting back down, and we're all tired now, and it's time for sleep. The David Cassidy posters have been mooned over. Poor guy's got Alzheimer's now. It's just, wow. All
really?
Things must pass, as George Harrison once said. Yep.
He does?
I don't think a lot about David Cassidy, but he was in the news, and apparently, yeah, it's not good. Oh, well. All right. On that downing note, do you have any pop matters?
I have been listening to two collections of CDs, both six CDs long.
Oh, my
God.
Okay.
Yes. And I've been making my way through them for the last 2 weeks. And you couldn't really, if you tried, have a better example of the catholicity of my interests. By the way, I managed to squeeze in Weird Al Yankovic's Mandatory Fun again just for shits and giggles, because Keith Jarrett was hurting me so bad.
There is a collaboration you need. Keith Jarrett, Weird Al. Make it happen.
Can you see that? I mean, oh my. Keith Jarrett would just kill him. He would just kill him. He would just beat him to death. He'd like stick his head in the piano and smash his head in. But two guys with, you know, fascinating hair, they should talk. Anyway, so two six CD sets, and I'm going to impress you with just how broad my musical range is now. Are you ready?
I'm belted in. Okay.
One is the six CD set called Can You Follow? The Jack Bruce six CD retrospective.
Wow. Okay.
And so this includes stuff from when I say it goes way back, it goes way back. So it starts with him. I'm scrolling down here to look at this real quick. Yeah, here we go. So it includes, of course, his own stuff. It includes when he was in Lifetime with Tony Williams, among other things.
Does it have stuff from Things We Like? I just remember as a kid, I don't have that recording anymore, but it was like a trio with a saxophone player who did like the Roland Kirk thing.
It depends on okay. I don't know. It has a bunch of stuff with him playing with Cream,
okay,
with Eric Clapton, with Manfred Mann. But wait. Oh, wait, friends. It gets better. His earliest recordings are on here with an early blues guy, a British blues guy that no one remembers, named Alexis Corner. He was part of Graham Bond's band. A bunch of recordings there. He was on one of the earliest iterations of John Mayall and the Blues Breakers.
Okay.
So he is a monumentally talented bass player.
And he's got jazz chops. I mean, the Things We Like album, I mean, is a jazz album. It is.
Yes. I mean, he can play jazz. So,
yeah, anyway.
He's played with Ginger Baker. He's played in a trio with Baker and somebody else called BBM. So it's Bruce Baker and I forget who the third party is. So he's got jazz he's a legit jazz player, among other things. But yeah, and he's not an untalented singer. I mean, he's not a great singer, but he's not bad.
He's
pretty good.
Chicago.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. No, he's definitely better than that. I mean, he's got a kind of thin, reedy voice, but he knows just how far he can push it, what he can do with it. So anyway, I've been listening to that 6 CD set, but I was surprised the last two discs have a lot of his own stuff from his own recordings where it's like he discovered horns. And so these are sort of power rock albums, but with some interesting horn arrangements on them. And it just kind of opens up a little bit. And it's I find myself enjoying them. He's toned down the chops. It's not that he doesn't have them. He's just dialed it back a little bit. And he's actually just making interesting music. I kind of like it. I was surprised how much I liked it. So that's one 6 CD set. All right. Now, are you ready for something completely different?
Absolutely. Right. Yeah.
The 6 CD set, it's called The Journey, : Destiny's Child. 6 CD career retrospective of Waylon Jennings.
Oh, it wasn't of Destiny's Child. Okay, I was assuming it was just Beyonce. Okay, Waylon Jennings. Okay.
Waylon Jennings. So like every CD has like 32 songs because they're all under 3 minutes. Wow. And there are several things that have been recorded more than once, but the earliest recordings go back to like the late 50s, and then they go up through the 80s. And it's kind of interesting. I actually kind of like Waylon Jennings, but one of the things that I was surprised by was in listening through this, I knew a lot of these songs already, but there's a handful of songs about the South will rise again and blah, blah, blah. And I don't think they're ironic. It's hard to, I listen to these songs and I'm like, maybe I'm just being sensitive, but this sounds like a little unapologetic Lynyrd Skynyrdy, like fuck you, Neil Young.
Right.
So I don't know about some of that stuff. I don't know, but he was famous as he started as a bass player, and I think he was with Buddy Holly, and he famously gave up his seat on the airplane. The Big Bopper. He was supposed to be on that airplane and he didn't get on the plane. The Big Bopper needed a ride. I think it's the Big Bopper. And he didn't make the plane that famously gave rise to the song, The Day the Music Died. And he starts out as kind of a Nashville dude, but
because the plane crashed for you young people. In other words, they played
listeners know, four or five famous musicians who died on that.
Right. It was a lot of the cream of the crop of 50s musicians. So it was kind of like a generation was kind of decimated. Yeah.
So and this just kind of follows him then up into the 80s. And when he first starts singing, he's kind of got this lilting high tenor. And then as he gets older, he's got this really burnished baritone, kind of gravelly. You know, he kind of grows into his voice. And a surprising number of Beatles covers here. Surprising. I'm not kidding. Norwegian Wood.
I believe it.
Yeah. Norwegian Wood, You've Got to Hide Your Love Away. And then, of course, like everyone else, lots of Mississippi Delta Blues covers, which is kind of interesting. So he's perhaps the unheralded or least heralded member in some ways of that kind of outlaw country gang. But he's most known probably to listeners of our vintage as the narrator of and the singer of the theme song on Dukes of Hazzard.
Wow.
Yes.
Somehow I missed that show.
Well, you don't know what you're missing, mister. That was a great program.
Yeah, someday I will do the archival work necessary.
Can you imagine a television show that has a car with a rebel flag on it, that its honked horn is Land of Cotton? That was a TV show. It was a TV show.
I can imagine one in about 6 months, so brace yourselves, people.
I mean, that was on TV when we were kids.
I know.
Now, I mean, there's a reason why that only makes it onto like certain cable channels, the country music channel or whatever.
There we go.
BET is not showing that anytime soon. You know, Dukes of Hazzard retrospective.
No, I wouldn't think so.
Cooter's Revenge, you know? No, I don't know.
Oh, God.
Sorry. So that's what I've been listening to. And you can't imagine these are both bass players, but you can't imagine two dudes farther apart than Waylon Jennings and Jack Bruce. Perhaps they're the same man. Have you ever seen them in a room together?
Well, okay.
I didn't think so.
My mother told me good. My mother told me strong. She said be true to yourself and you can't go wrong. But there's just one thing that you must understand. You can fool with your brother, but don't mess with a missionary man. Don't mess with
I went to an event that was about bringing dudes together. So we went to Dance Kaleidoscope, Joyce and I, for around the Valentine's Day weekend. And Dance Kaleidoscope is a dance group based in Indianapolis. And they were doing a series of dances devoted to divas. So the first half was just individual songs, including Missionary Man by the Eurythmics, one of my all-time favorites.
Yeah, it's a good song. But it's not their song. It's not somebody's older. Is it a cover?
I have no idea. Celine Dion doing something awful to a standard.
Oh, God. Okay.
And then this young man came out because each one was choreographed by a different person. So this guy...
Were you at a drag club? Was that what you were at?
I wasn't, but it was close. It was a dance group. And I love this dance troupe because their lead dancer is this blonde woman who's like 5 foot tall. She is the shortest member of the troupe. And there's just no way you think a ballerina has to be, you know, willowy and tall. And she's like, no, I'm a spark plug. Fuck you. I'm the hardest dancing woman in this group, and I'm in charge. So she got to be in the second half. They did stuff by Janis Joplin and then stuff by Aretha Franklin.
Nice.
Yeah, it was, both sections were fine. And as I said, the first half was just a series of different individual songs. And so the choreographer for one of them came out and explained, my favorite artist is Barbra Streisand, and my favorite song is Don't Rain on My Parade. And I was singing it at karaoke, and I've never felt more fabulous. And I was just thinking,
wow.
Why can't Mike Pence
be... You were at a drag club.
Why can't Mike Pence be next to me now? It'd be good for him, or it would make his head explode. One of the two. I think that was the one that involved... It was a small group of dancers. One was clearly kind of the liberated dancing guy. And then there was a couple that were dressed like tourists, and the guy had a backpack, and Joyce couldn't figure out why. But it's because when he spins away from the woman and spins towards the liberated guy can draw rainbow handkerchiefs out of the backpack. And, you know, it just occurred to me that everybody's
you
got...
You were at a drag club, you big liar. You thought you were going to some artsy thing. You're at a drag... Lace boys do cabaret. Go ahead.
Yeah, anyway, it just occurred to me that everyone has got a rainbow handkerchief in their backpack. They look hard enough. Even Mike Pence. I bet he's got a few square inches in there of shimmery cloth. If he just dug deep enough past
I can't
all the
get
Bibles.
Past square inches, but...
Yeah. Anyway, I wish he'd been there. It would have been eye-opening, and who knows what else it might have opened in him. But he wasn't. It was
any other music you've been listening to? That's dance. Stick with the remit, motherfucker.
Hey, it did... get me to re-listen to Janis Joplin's Pearl. And
didn't get you to re-listen to Celine Dion?
Re-listen? Have you stopped beating your wife? Oh, God. Fuck that Canadian. Anyway.
You would if she let you.
Oh, God. A horse is a horse, of course. Yes. So I listened to Tycho. He is a rock instrumentalist. His release, Epic, is kind of bland. Can't recommend it too much. It's just rock instrumentals, dance-ish. I will say if you play it loud enough, it makes more sense, but I just listened to it and there's nothing particularly surprising melodically or harmonically or in terms of texture. It's not bad. It's just it doesn't surprise you ever. So, blah. Cherry Glazer, never heard of it. Apocalypstic, 30-minute album.
Great title.
Highly recommended.
And just for the title, it's worth listening to.
Well, and it turns out that's the last song in the album, and it's an instrumental. I'm like, come on, you've got to have lyrics to Apocalypstic. So anyway, yeah, this is a group led by a woman who recently graduated from high school, Clementine Creevy, and it is awesome. I really enjoy it. It's a lot of fun, short post-punk album. It's not punk. It's melodic. The arrangements I actually like. They're not super complicated. I don't know if I want to say it's sort of like Loveless on speed. I can't quite place the style. I don't know that it's all that innovative. It's just one that I really enjoy, and it's the kind of album that I've played it once, and then I want to play it again right away. It's just very good to do the dishes to, but a lot of fun. She's kind of yowling, but it's never really atonal, and it's very well produced, and the band is just always interesting. You know, it's never just kind of gets in a rut, and it's just a lot of fun. I don't know that she's got anything to say particularly, but it's certainly entertaining. So I was real pleased to find that because it's rare that I find a record that I like that much. Finally, I'm still not going to talk about Anderson .Paak's Malibu. I've listened to it once or twice, but I just got so much stuff here that I'm going to save it for another week. But I did listen to Ogden Nuts Gone Flake by the Small Faces. their concept album from the late 60s.
I have their collected. I have an five disc Small Faces, so I must have listened to that.
Maybe you're the one who sent me the Faces. See, what the Small Faces.
Oh, right. That's
then
after,
became the Faces. This is pre. Do you think I'm Sexy Stewart? Yeah.
By the way, do you know why they were called the Small Faces?
No idea. Weren't they all small? Just small.
They're all like 5'6" and under. They're all really short.
Yeah, it's like a tiny band.
When Rod Stewart joined the band, he was like 5'9" and he was head and shoulders above everyone else. I mean, I think 5'6" is tops. I think they were closer to like 5 feet. They're just really small guys. And I think I told you they were famous for having like a bar on stage. Like they would serve themselves liquor while they played. They were a total bar band.
So if you think about sort of psychedelic albums from the 60s, you know, at one end you've got the Zombies, who are kind of all, they sound like they've been to Cambridge, right? And this is kind of the opposite. These are the Cockney roustabouts doing a concept album. So the first six songs on the side A are just a series of tunes. And then the second side is this weird fairy tale narrated by this guy named Unwin, who kind of speaks a mixture of Cockney slang and gobbledygook. It's a fairy tale about a guy who's looking for the missing half of a moon. The little bits between don't go on too long, and it does set this kind of fairy tale mood. It actually works okay. It's not real annoying. The songs are all energetic. The drummer is Kenny Jones, who many years later joined The Who after Keith Moon drank himself to death. And listening to this album, you can imagine why they would have called up Kenny Jones, because at this stage, he sort of sounds like a slightly less frenetic Keith Moon. It's that style of drumming. I've only heard it streaming. It's kind of sounds like crap. In other words, it's not, as far as I can tell, a well-produced album. But it's a lot of fun. There's a lot of energy. None of the tunes are duds. Some of them are quite hilarious. And it's this bizarre mix of, I guess in a certain way, kind of Cockney humor and surrealism aren't really that far apart. To some degree, like, you know, the original Beatles movie, The Hard Day's Night, you can see that juxtaposition there, right? That it's not entirely separate, those points of view. And so you get both of them here. I mean, it is not the dreamy sounds of the Zombies. This is you know, a sort of music hall mixed with psychedelia. But it's pretty successful. I enjoyed it. Yeah, I'd recommend it. I don't know if I'm actually going to get it, you know, purchase it. But it was neat to be able to listen to it a few times through Amazon, because I, for whatever reason, it just kind of came on my radar and thought, well, can I track this down? And, oh, here it is. Cool. So I'd recommend, you know, if you've got Amazon Prime or you can track down a copy, it's definitely worth hearing. But apparently this was their third album. It was their attempt at sort of a concept album. They kind of hedged their bets by only making one half of it, you know, actually a concept. And the concept is as silly and lighthearted as it possibly could be. And then they kind of broke up and reformed as the Faces. Again, kind of a neat find. It's not going to hold its place in the place of my heart of something like Forever Changes or Odyssey and Oracle, but it's a lot of fun.
Well, having said all that, you put me in mind of three other things I was listening to.
Okay.
So I'm going to tell you about them as well. Sorry. Okay. And these are all female groups. So in my ongoing quest to check out things from the library that are on recent lists, I checked out Ariana Grande's, Grand's Dangerous Woman. Boy, is this a piece of shit. I mean, it's not incompetent, but it's just studio-driven schlock.
Is she kind of like a real pyrotechnical singer? She's got like lots of...
No,
okay. For some reason, I thought, you know, I've not heard her stuff.
I believe I think she's from Florida. She's sort of perky and peppy, and like a lot of female pop stars, has a turn to the dark side. You know, it's the Britney Spears move, right? Except not nearly as convincing, you know. I mean, so calling your album Dangerous Woman doesn't make you a dangerous woman. It just makes you a marketing tool.
She's the one with a cat ear headphone, so I think she's got a ways to go. Those aren't dangerous.
Something. Yes, I just, I don't hate it. I mean, it's totally competent pop, but it's not very interesting, if you ask me.
Well, yeah.
Slightly more interesting and infinitely more disturbing was an album that I got called Hero by Maren Morris, M-A-R-E-N Morris. This is ostensibly country, although this is country from the Taylor Swift school, so it's almost has hip-hop beats to it. And it was written and recorded by a 17-year-old, and motherfucker does that show. The lyrics are beyond callow. they're embarrassing. And it's the kind of thing, I think, that when this person gets older, they'll realize, oh, shit, I recorded that. Perhaps the most disturbing song on it. So it's not – sonically, it's interesting, right? The sort of auto-tuned, heavy backbeat sound with like metropolitan twang. That's kind of interesting to me. The lyrics are terrible. And the worst is a song called How It's Done, in which 17-year-old Maren Morris tells us she's going to show – she's singing to her man, and she's going to show him how it's done. And I just thought, even Britney Spears didn't go this far into kiddie porn. It's just a really disturbing song, and there's not any sense of irony to it. There's not any sense of like clever ha-ha, I'm making fun of these. It's like, I'm just a 17-year-old, but I'm going to show you how it's done. And I'm like, really? Because I'm 50, and I got a feeling you can't really show me anything I don't already know. It just made me really feel dirty afterwards. And so,
at least not with police present, yeah.
Both of these albums made me feel dirty. And so, in order to cleanse my soul, I dredged up out of the archives and put back in rotation the collection of songs by the original Riot Girl group, Bikini Kill, their album called Singles. 10 songs, about 19 minutes long, the whole album. I mean, it's just fucking awesome. Song titles are Anti-Pleasure Dissertation, I hate Danger, I Like Fucking, Rah Rah Replica, Strawberry Julius, Rebel Girl. My favorite song is Rebel Girl, which is 2 minutes of just them screaming, Rebel Girl! Just off key, out of key. And they're basically saying to you, fuck you, you know, fuck you for making us into sex symbols or whatever else you want. We own our bodies. We own everything. We are scarier than you could ever imagine. And it's like 20 minutes of just raw girl anger, you know, and I felt my soul was cleansed afterwards. And I'm looking forward to playing some of these songs before lecture for my students. You know, I often play music before lecture and I play different things, you know. But yeah, I really think they need to hear Rebel Girl or I Like Fucking. Just a two minute. And these are punk. I mean, this is Seattle. This is Northwest Seattle punk. This is the shit that Kurt Cobain was listening to when he was 14. They're just politically out there and barely tuned guitars, really loud thrashing drums. And as I said, the longest song on this album is 2 minutes and 49 seconds. And that's exactly as it should be. I mean, it's truly a 20-minute album. That is just like the fucking bomb. I think it's great. So,
yeah. Well, Apocalyptic is not that. It is not punk, and it is over 30 minutes, so not a lot, but it's...
That's okay.
There is, you know, while being a little bit more produced or whatever, there's still some rawness, there's still some humor, and it's a lot of fun, but it's a little gentler on the ears. It's, like I said, I think of it kind of as a post-punk mode. It's one I like, and again, I think the band is constantly entertaining me in little ways, which not always the case in some of these recent releases. Mitski's Puberty 2, right, for instance, where the band just kind of bored me half the time.
I don't think Bikini Kill is trying to entertain you. They're trying to bludgeon you, and they dare you to get up. And if you do, they'll beat you over the head again with their guitar.
You know? When they're through with you, you just want to go record for ECM.
That's right. You're like, I'm sorry. I take it
more
all back.
More reverb, Manfred. Please, more reverb. I just can't express
all
my
of
melancholy.
All of the songs of Bikini Kill sound like they're recorded inside a closet. And they're probably recorded, you know, in a live club, but it sounds like literally four people in a 5x5 room.
And that concludes Jazz Bastard Podcast 111. How do you feel about recent ECM? Let us know at pat@jazzbastard.com, mike@jazzbastard.com, or at our lovely Facebook page. If there's some recent ECM releases that we've been missing and that are really excellent, please let us know about them. We're not trying to be down on the label as a whole. Tune in next time for works by Jason Moran, Stanley Clark, The Bad Plus Joshua Redmond, and John Hollenbeck. Till then, take care.